Hello and welcome to the Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, information and an archive of past episodes. Hello and welcome to the Fergan. I'm your host Dan, as always, and this will be the final episode before Yule of 2022. And I did think about doing a podcast episode dedicated to Yule and to talking about the tradition, but instead, I think I have something better because to me this is a very kind of magical time of year, a very spiritual time of year, and also a very inspiring time of year, both in terms of creative endeavors and also in terms of making new oaths to oneself more than anything else. And so the guest I have on today is a man from Sweden called Anders Nilsson, and he wrote a book called Odinsveg. In English, The Way of Wotan, which I read recently. It was recommended to me by several people who I trust and respect. And it was also suggested to me that I invite Anders on to discuss the ideas which he presents in the book. Anders, it's good to be speaking with you, and thank you for joining us on the Fergan podcast. And if you could just give the listeners just a little idea about your background, who you are, and how long you've been practicing, and Asatru or heathenry, and
yeah. Okay. Thank you for inviting me. I'm very pleased.
You're very welcome.
Yeah. Well, I'm. As you said, a native Swede, born and raised here on the West Coast, in a place where we have a very strong presence of the Bronze Age. We have the most rock carvings in all of Europe here, centered in one little place. I don't know why they were here, but it's cool. So I just turned 45, which is a good number. It turns out to be 9.
Yeah,
I like nines.
Yeah.
So let's see what this year has to bring. I'm a father of two strong guys. And I've been working as a bricklayer most of my life. Got a slip disc, so had to change direction there. But, and for the also true practice part, I've sort of, I don't know, it started very early. I got my first rune book when I was 15, I think, or 14. Did my first rune set then and started interact with all the sacred sites we have around here. But it actually started when I was very, very young. Seeing sort of the spirits of the land here walking around, watching me. And it was even so that I was a bit ashamed of me running around in the forest playing military, and they were standing there and, come on, grow up. Sort of. So it's that part of me has always been there.
Well, sorry, just to interrupt briefly. When you say they watched you, do you how literally do you mean that? What did you have any experiences growing up where you really kind of encountered these entities? You know, the land whites.
Oh yeah, many.
Okay.
And that is why it's so natural for me, or strong, if you would say. It's not a belief I have. It's a, you know, it's a living thing. I see dead people.
Yeah.
No, but it, actually, I don't know. I don't see them like with my waking eyes, but I can smell them, feel the presence, and see them in, yeah, well,
in your mind's eye.
Yeah. Wonderful. And sometimes they interact in a physical way. Sometimes it's good, and sometimes it's not that good.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, my wife seems to have that gift. You know, she senses presences in a similar way to how you describe. Usually within houses, though, you know, she usually senses the, you know, the house whites or the presences, the presumably the entities who have inhabited the houses that we've lived in. And yeah. She usually sees them in doorways. She seems to see them in doorways or hallways, things like that, you know, the kind of the boundaries between two spaces and things. Is that the kind of thing that you've experienced?
Yeah, it's exactly like that.
Okay. Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. Well, maybe a little bit later on, we can talk a little bit more about that, and I can just briefly share my own experiences. Cause yeah, I'd love to talk more about that with you if we have time.
But, sure.
Yeah, you're also the man who introduced Odin World Prayer Day to the world, right? You came up with that whole concept, which is now practiced by many heathens around the world, and is promoted by none other than Stephen McNallan.
Yeah, that was 2015, I think I started.
Okay.
And then I was still allowed on Facebook. And, you know, they have their, you can create a event and invite people and share that event and so on. So that's how I started it. So in the beginning, we were like 300 people checking the box there, coming. And I did a count. It was like 5,000 rituals or something for a few years. And almost every continent was included. I even did a Google Maps I shared where I put all the dots where people said, I'm joining. It was a lot of dots.
Yeah, amazing. And the idea of that is that on the ninth day of each month at 9 o'clock, wherever you are, you perform blot to Odin. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And my initial thought was that I saw so many people practicing alone and didn't really... I mean, if you are alone, it's quite hard to do a proper blot. So I thought of the Vedic way of honoring their gods and goddesses, especially Shiva, then, with the pouring of liquid on the lingam and saying his 108 names. So I connected those two because I worked with Shiva also before. And there are many layers to this Odin World Prayer Day. The deepest layer is that I wanted to collect as much energy for awakening the Odin in us. And him as a god, giving energy and feeding him.
Yeah.
That is the deepest level of it. And the second level is for people to, I mean, when you offer to him, you also offer to yourself. It's a combined thing there.
Mm-hmm.
He is part of us as we are part of him.
Yeah.
So
sacrifice myself to myself. You know,
He created us from ash and elm.
Yeah, of course.
Go on.
Yeah, I was just in preparation for this discussion. I was reading a book I have called Hammer of the Gods by Swain Wodening, because what we're going to be talking about in this episode are the parts of the soul of the heathen soul. which is something that Anders has, his book is largely based on, and he is quite knowledgeable on, or I should say very knowledgeable on. And we have slightly different names in the English tradition, but I mean, just very slightly. And one of the things refreshing my memory of that book is the idea that when we bloat to the gods, or, you know, with the gods, I should say, there's this exchange of energy, this, you know, gift for a gift principle. And the idea may be that we are harnessing some of the what in Old English is called magan, the kind of personal for strength or power of the gods. So what you're talking about with Odin World Prayer Day is all of these people all over the world, kind of like nodes, you know, to use technical jargon, these people all over the world at roughly the same time, because obviously there's time differences and things, but on that same day, everyone is honoring Odin, and in exchange for the energy that we give Odin, we also receive that same energy in return. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is very much, very much so.
Okay, and that's the intention with Odin World Prayer Day. It's to strengthen heathens worldwide to strengthen the bond that we have with Odin.
Yeah, and awakening him, giving more power to him.
Yeah,
it's perfect. Like Carl Gustav Jung said that. He's like an old dried up riverbed.
Yeah.
And we will open the floodgates for him.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. A phrase that, and I repeat this so often, but my good friend Phil from Mimisbrunner, he once said something to me which sticks with me all the time. He says that the gods push with us, not for us. So we can't expect the gods to act independently on our behalf. We need to be the first ones there on the front line. We need to be, as you say, opening those pathways, unblocking those dried up riverbeds and things, so that the gods can return and that they can flow within us again. I think too many people have this idea that, you know, you'll often hear people say, well, where's the evidence of the gods? Well, I say, well, you have to show willing first, and then you will receive that kind of notification from them, that relationship.
Yeah, it's, I mean, this path of spirituality is not an easy path. It's, I mean, you have to work. It's dedication and discipline, most of all.
Yeah, and that's something that you mentioned in your book as well, is that the time and effort that we give in preparing for our rituals is itself a form of sacrifice.
Yeah, and I mean, what is the most valuable thing we have today? Well, it's our time.
Yeah.
If you give of your time, you're actually giving up a part of your life. 1 minute of your time is, well, that's the 1 minute of your life.
Yeah.
And that is why it's so destructive with all these social media and games and all those things, because they earn money on your lifetime that you're giving away for nothing.
Yeah,
that is quite terrible.
Yeah, it is. And aside from the kind of wisdom shared in your book, The Way of Wotan, that's one thing that I came away thinking from it was this idea that so many aspects of the modern world are detrimental to our spiritual well-being. And that kind of seems like an obvious thing to say, but when you put it in terms like you've just put it, that even 1 minute of our time is, it's 1 minute within this incarnation of our lives that we will never get back. And it therefore, it is very precious. And yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I think, you've definitely kind of, through reading that book, you've compelled me to think much harder about just how much time I do give to things like technology. And it's something that I've been aware of for a long time. But sometimes you kind of forget how much of a sacrifice and an unnecessary sacrifice things like social media can be.
Yeah, I mean, I know. We all know. I mean, they are so clever. They've created these things so we get hooked. I mean, they have all these psychologists and behavioral scientists that sit and plan all this. They know our brain.
Yeah.
What works. Yeah. And that is also very scary.
Yeah. Yeah. In some ways, they know us better than we know ourselves.
Yeah.
So, going back to
Odin World Prayer, there, one thing that was very interesting in the start was the huge reaction against the word prayer. Oh, I had to defend that word. But I really, really didn't want to change it. Because if you don't, I mean, they were so Christianized in their thinking of the word prayer. Yeah. I'm not praying to get something. I mean, prayer for me is a communion.
Yeah.
I interact. I'm not begging. I give. And then I receive the amount that I give. I mean, if I give little, I receive back little. That is how it works.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, in my personal practice, which is often alone, you know, I celebrate the kind of high holy tides with my family usually, but the kind of smaller, more frequent bloats I do are myself alone. And I make a conscious effort to not always be asking for something. I sometimes perform blots simply to thank whichever gods I'm addressing at the time for something that has gone right, or just what I've been blessed with in life, or my family and things like that, rather than every time going to that sacred spot and communing with the gods to ask for something. And I agree. I mean, I growing up in kind of like a Christian society, as I'm sure you did, I actually remember that prayer wasn't always seen as a demand, but it was sometimes you would pray to say thanks. So I'm amazed that people took your use of the word prayer to mean that you were kind of begging or something.
Yeah, that was the first reaction, very strong reaction.
Yeah.
So I had to fight that one. But yeah. That's also one thing in spirituality, stand your ground.
Yeah.
If you feel something is right in your heart, well, stand your ground. Don't back down.
Yeah, and there are always going to be people who nitpick, you know, who look for flaws in what you're doing, or look for some kind of weakness that they can attack. And usually it's because there's something missing in their own practice, or their own understanding, or their own, you know, whatever. I mean, this is an obvious thing to say. We all know this, that there are people out there who only only know how to tear others down rather than building themselves up.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you just kind of brushed them aside and continued with it, because it, you know, Odin World Prayer Day seems to have become a very powerful kind of institution in worldwide heathenry.
Yeah. We succeeded in that.
Yeah, well, congratulations. And then, from like more recently, and you know, this is kind of my first real exposure to your ideas was through reading your recent book, Odinsveg, or The Way of Wotan. So, what compelled you to write that book? You know, you talk a little bit in the introduction to the book that, you know, these are kind of ideas. I think you said you had maybe some notes or articles that were kind of lying around and people that had encouraged you to put them in book form. What was it that made you want to put this into book form? And, you know, was it because you felt that like there were this knowledge was lacking within the heathen kind of scene?
Well, first it was a friend of mine, Linus Borgström, who also actually he did the English translation of the book, and I think it was very good.
Very good, yeah. Very.
He had a podcast, Folkpodden, and we were going to make a series of podcasts about each of these names.
Hmm.
That never happened. The book happened instead.
Okay.
So I started to write the, you know, like short words to discuss around, and then it just flowed on.
Yeah, and for those who haven't read the book yet, and I highly recommend that. I mean, it's a book which covers the more esoteric kind of, I guess, metaphysical side of heathenry. It's very much kind of designed for kind of solo practice for the most part, although there are Anders does include rites at the end of the book in the appendix, which are rites which I believe can some of them be performed as part of a group, but most of the thrust of the book is geared towards that kind of solo, that important solo self-practice that needs doing, the meditative practice that needs doing. And in the book, Anders goes through the most of the parts of the soul as kind of detailed in Northern lore. Would you mind kind of just giving an overview of the book, just talking about what it is that you wanted to achieve with the book? Why did you think that information was so important to get across to people?
Well, that is to help people, actually. To help people get free, to find themselves.
Did you feel that there's too much emphasis on the kind of exoteric heathen practice, the ceremonies and people going through the motions and performing the very kind of, the best word I can think of is the exoteric side of it. And did you think that there was kind of a lacking of the more esoteric kind of the attention to the aspects of one's soul and the kind of eternal self? Is that what your thinking was?
Yeah, I really think so. And if you want to start practicing any religion or spirituality, you first need to find yourself in some way, or find something in there before you start. Otherwise, you're just doing theater for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah,
I might be quite harsh there, but you get what I'm saying, I think.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and I'm kind of trying to avoid speaking too much here, because I know, people want to hear from Anders, but I am really excited about this topic. And the reason for that is because I was one of these kind of heathens who it took me a very long time to kind of accept to fully immerse myself in heathen practice. And I think the reason for that was because I wanted to understand why we would do these things, why we would perform these rituals before I would actually give over to them. And for me, it wasn't until I came across the information regarding the heathen soul and the afterlife that it really made sense for me. I remember many, many years ago when Varg Vikernes ran a blog before he had a YouTube channel even. I remember there was a lot of discussion in the comments under each of his blog articles, and someone there introduced me to the concepts of Julius Evola, his ideas about the Olympian versus the chthonic, the solar man versus the chthonic man. And so much of what I knew of paganism before that was it was all geared towards the chthonic, the kind of animistic side of it, this idea that I actually came across lots of information saying that pagans simply didn't believe in an afterlife at all, and that we were just these kind of, parts of a whole. And when we died, we simply fed the earth, and that was it. That was the end of us. So it wasn't until I came across this information through books like Hammer of the Gods, as I mentioned earlier. And, this is the kind of information that Anders is presenting in his book. And that side of it really excited me, because it really kind of hits home. It for me, there's an enormous power in knowing these aspects of oneself. As Anders said, you need to know yourself before you can know the kind of the wider practice of it. So I don't know if you have any comments on that. I mean, did you ever come across these ideas that there is no afterlife, that there is no soul in the pagan worldview? How do you feel about those ideas?
Actually, I never heard that. But I know what you feel with the darker side of it, that everything must be so dark and brutal and, yeah, all that. But I think I've studied and practiced some of the Vedic traditions, sort of run through my family for a strange way, but I think that is where this deeper esoteric, I mean, connection with the gods comes from, because they are so dedicated to that side.
In the Vedic tradition.
Yeah, and I couldn't really find that in our path.
Hmm.
It's more archaeology and studying on the surface.
Yeah. You mentioned in the book that you were inspired partly by Stephen McNallan. Would I be right in saying that it was things like his cauldron meditation that inspired you? Mm. Are you aware of
No, not really in that way.
Okay.
But Steve, I've been a member in the Austrian Folk Assembly for quite some years.
Yeah.
So me and Steve, we have talked. Stephen wasn't here, but the other ones was here a few summers ago. I visited.
Hmm. And Stephen wrote the introduction to your book.
Yeah. And Freya Aswin wrote the afterword.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
She is really, really. She's really good. She's a strong woman.
I had a tangent here. A few months ago, I performed a private Zoom concert. Some of my songs from my Project Walkensman.
Okay.
There were only about 15 people listening. It was like a Zoom concert. And it's not something that I've been in the habit of doing, but one of the people who happened to be present there was Freya Aswin.
Oh, cool.
And I didn't know that she was going to be there. And I think she was only there because she had been one of the performers of the evening. She had been giving a talk or something like that. I can't remember exactly what, but I performed for her, and I believe that she was quite impressed with my songs. So that was a real honor.
Yeah. I've talked to her. She's a strong woman.
yeah, for sure. Yeah, she's a real kind of warrior for heathen tradition. Yeah. Would you mind just, I don't want to ask you to kind of give away the contents of your book, of course, because people should be reading it. It's a really good, concise book, and I think it's something that I'll be returning to again and again. It's quite easy to reference. But the kind of core of the book is that you detail the parts of the soul. Would you mind kind of talking us, because some people listening to this won't have any idea of this. They'll have no knowledge of the what our ancestors believed constitutes the heathen soul.
Well, we can say that the concept of that we have one soul, that is quite new and Abrahamic.
Yeah.
So that said, but for us, I can just read them out here. The first one is our body, then, as a physical body, and that's called Lik. And that's a quite funny name, because Lik in Swedish means corpse. So a dead thing, if you don't fill it with the other stuff that comes next. And next one is Ek, and that is our sort of what I perceive as me, Anders, the self, the ego. When I look into the mirror, I see my face, that is Ek, me. Mm. And then comes Hugr, and that is our senses, our thoughts, feelings, emotions, everything that happens around there. And then we have another one, and that is Mini, and that is the memory. Memory of our present life. I mean, like a hardware, sort of, where you store stuff.
Yeah.
And then the biggest one, the hardest one to explain, Ond. And that is the soul, or the, what do you say, spark. The spark in us.
Yeah.
The undying thing. And Ond in Swedish, it's under, spirit. So it's almost the same, Ond and under. And then we have some, that is our main part of our being. And we have three more that is not part of us, but integrates very much with us. And that is the Hamingja. And that is what they, what you can say, the collective unconscious, or where the karma is stored, and well, sort of the internet of the souls.
Yeah, if you don't mind me saying, I in my notes I wrote it as the folk memory or the folk soul, which I think is a concept that most people listening will have heard before. Would you agree with that?
Definitely. And there is also where we can do the most, good and most bad. I mean, your actions in your life affects the collective Hamingja, which will be inborn into the next generation. So all the traumas and scary stuff. I mean, I think I have it in the book where there is a scientist who experimented on mice. He gave the mice mother some really good cheese, but then repeatedly started giving that mice electrical shots every time. And the offspring of that mice mother never ate that cheese. So she... Yeah, they inherited her memory, her trauma of that happening.
Yeah, for sure.
So all that lies in Hamingja.
Yeah, and I can kind of we have like a small rat problem in our home at the moment, and it's the first time I've had to really deal with that, and we set some traps, and the rats have been avoiding all of the traps.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder, you know, is that part of their Hamingja? You know, is that part of their folk memory? You know, have maybe they themselves have never seen a rat trap before, but their ancestors have, and therefore they are just naturally skeptical of it.
Yeah, definitely so. And here, if we understand that what we're saying, you know, we can also understand that this part is where the bloats and the rituals and our spiritual discipline will affect the future.
Yeah.
This is how we can change the future.
Through our rituals.
I mean, changing the Hamingja, doing good. Mm. I mean, building our own Hamingja will increase the folk Hamingja in the end.
Yeah.
Or if you do the other, if you do bad stuff, you will ruin the Hamingja.
Yeah,
so,
indeed.
So much to talk about there, but let's go on to the next. Let it vode. And vode, it's come from Voden, of course. Vode, vet, vedanas. It's the inspiration and sort of the possession you can get when you do something you really like. And if you're a painter, I mean, or a artist in some, well, you are a musician, you get lost when you sing, sort of lose track of time and space. And that is the vode, the force of the vode that grips you.
It's that kind of inspirational, that frenzy of inspiration, isn't it? And when I was looking through Hammer of the Gods to look at the English, because I'm more familiar with the English names for these concepts, and Swain Wodening writes in there, he mentions that he says, strangely enough, the wode was given to man by Willa, which is a presumably Vili. the God of the will and therefore self-control. So he's saying it's strange that the God of self-control would give man that kind of that that frenzy that can't be controlled. And I was thinking about that for a moment, and I was thinking, actually, that kind of makes perfect sense. That you would be the God that grants you the ability to have self-control also grants you the freedom to relinquish that self-control occasionally when needed.
Yeah, and maybe most important, to control it.
Yes, yeah.
So you don't get obsessed or possessed by it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's his gift.
Yeah.
And next one is the Filga, of course. And that is the protective spirit that walks with us, or some of us. Also, a lot of talking about that. But the Filga is not a part of our being, but walks with us as a part. And we can strengthen her by doing good acts or courageous acts, being a good man or a woman. We can attract a stronger Filga, and we can scare away our Filga by doing bad stuff. And the Filga is also something that walks with peoples, lands, tribes, bigger Filgas. It is an entity, sort of.
Yeah, could you speak a bit more on this? Because you have some really good thoughts on this, and it's an aspect of the, not an aspect of the soul, but an aspect of your ideas, which is really interesting. You say that not everyone has a Filga. You also mention, I also noticed that you said her. For a man, is the Filga always feminine? And for a woman, is the Filga masculine?
No.
Okay, always feminine.
No.
Okay.
It could be an animal.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Probably could be also be a tree, I guess.
Okay, because in some of the English sources for information about this, and I know that Brian Bates, when he wrote The Way of Weird, the way he presented the fetch, as it's called in English, or the Filga, was that for a man it was an entity of the opposite sex, and in a sense it was kind of that that sort of Jungian true love that that you unite with upon death. I don't know if it's quite the same in the Norse lore, I think the idea that Brian Bates had is that sometimes the Filga is in the form of a woman, and sometimes it's the form of an animal, or perhaps that it changes shape.
Yeah, I think it's very. I think it could be actually anything.
Right. Okay.
Not anything. Not a car, but. But in the history, most often it's animals, and of course the warriors, they have their Valkyrie Filga sort of thing.
Okay, and when you say that not everyone has one, what's the reason for that? Is that because is everyone granted a Filga at birth, and some people lose their Filga, or is it something you have to earn?
Yeah, and also talking about the Hamingja there, but has your previous, what do you say, folk, previous relatives done?
Right, yeah.
Have they scared away the Filga by doing really bad stuff?
Yeah.
Maybe. That's also you can inherit Filga in the family.
Yeah.
And if you are strong, you can get a Filga for yourself.
Right. And I know it's quite personal to ask, so, you know, feel free not to answer, and you don't have to give any detail, but have you had direct experiences with your own Filga?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I had a bear for a very long time. a full grown. Well, it was a female bear.
Okay.
Now when we're talking, but then one night I woke up, and that bear left me, and put a little cub bear on my chest.
Okay. Yeah.
That was so cute. You imagine a little cub lying on my chest in totally peace. So that one is my current filia.
Okay. And what significance do you think there was in this kind of changing of the guard, so to speak, you know, this this fully grown female bear, you know, leaving you presumably her cub? Was what do you think that represents? I don't want to say represent as in suggesting that this is all symbolic by any means. I'm not suggesting that for a moment, but I believe there's probably some significance to the fact that it your filia was a fully grown female bear and is now a cub.
Well, probably they have their life of their own that I don't know of in their dimension. Maybe she was old, tired of being a filia.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's a lot of responsibility, right?
Yeah. So, but well. But I've met a lot of people who had many different forms, and some have ancestors that take on the form of a filia.
Yeah.
So how that works for real, I don't know.
Yeah, I must admit that it's... When I first got into heathenry, I did quite a lot of meditative practice. I had a lot more... This is a bit of a cop-out, but I had a lot more free time then. Yeah. And now I'm an extremely busy family man. And I do struggle to find the time for this kind of this attention to the self. So my relationship or knowledge or with my filia, if I indeed have one at the moment, is kind of unknown to me, and it's something that I need to strengthen for sure. But you know, some people will simplify the filia to this idea of a kind of like a guardian spirit. In what sense do you think that the filia guards us or looks after us or looks over us, if at all?
Ooh, well, see, it's like a, what do you say, like a sixth sense, sort of intuition.
Yeah.
Might be where intuition comes from.
Like a gut instinct.
Yeah, sort of. A hunch.
Yeah.
Not like they are opening doors for us, but yeah.
That's really interesting, that this idea that the filia manifests in the form of gut instinct. You know, what we call gut instinct, this, you know, when we just get a hunch about something, then that's perhaps our filia communicating to us in a very subtle way that we should or shouldn't do something.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Because the mind or the mini, I believe, as you call it, that's kind of the more rational side of ourselves, right? That's kind of the filter through which you know our five senses, you know, they get filtered through our mind. But when we have a sixth sense, obviously beyond the five senses, that comes from somewhere else. That comes from a different aspect of ourselves and our existence.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Actually, that might be the filia's work.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes perfect sense.
It's quite, I mean, all these names here that makes up our soul complex, it's, they are not, I had very, I had problems not making them separate in the book, because they are not separate. Without any one of them, you get mad or you die. I mean, if you lose leak your body, well, then you die. If you lose memory, well, then you have big problems. So all of them are interacting. They are one and the same.
Yeah, and this idea, and this is another strong idea that I came away with from reading your book is that these ideas, they defy this ridiculous idea that the material realm, Midgard or Midgard, is some kind of prison. You know, there's those who have this kind of misunderstanding of Gnosticism or, you know, other various kind of world-denying religions. Even Christianity, I would suggest, is a world-denying religion, because it's looking ahead to this glorious afterlife, and the your existence on Earth is kind of seen as this this horrible process that you have to go through to reach heaven. Whereas what you describe with these parts of the soul is that actually it's almost like we have many feet and we have one foot in each different kind of dimension, and this material realm, Midgard, is just one of those dimensions, and it's not any less or more important than the other ones. And it's through our leak that we are able to, the other aspects of the soul are able to operate.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that I love so much about our tradition, is that it's not the extreme of we are just this kind of animistic being who dies, decays, and becomes part of the earth. But we're also not only a spiritual being who should just be looking to the afterlife. You know, that we all realms or all of the nine worlds are as important as one another, and the totality of our being allows us to experience all of them.
Yeah. But the hardest one there is on the soul. Hardest to explain, at least. But from my experience with the other side, so to say, is that the ond is the one thing that remains. If you die and, I mean, what do we say today, become a ghost, if you're not prepared for the dying and don't know how to go to the right side, or you, I mean, if you're in a trauma or in a car accident and die there suddenly, something will be left here, and that is the ond, I would say, that we perceive as ghosts or spirits, or that spark. The other parts, they vanish.
Right. And well, presumably our Hamingya, well, actually, no, you said that's not a part of ourselves, is it? That's a separate thing which we don't lay claim to, we don't lay ownership of. So if we die in a traumatic accident, then that doesn't have a bearing on the Hamingya, because that's shared with all of our folk, right?
Yeah. That's outside of ourselves. Yeah.
Okay, of course. So you, one thing that you mentioned in the book, and this is another thing which was quite important in my journey and my understanding, and I mentioned earlier the Avolian concept of the solar or Olympic man versus the Chthonic. And you mentioned in the book that the northern ambition is not the death of the self or the ego to merge with the oneness. Could you talk a little bit more about that? Because I know that in some religions that is obviously the goal. I believe Buddhism, although I'm not going to claim to know too much about Buddhism, but it is this idea of dissolving the ego and becoming part of this kind of this one universal cosmic consciousness. But that's not quite the way that our ancestors saw things, right?
No, that is true. I mean, we are loving the life we are living. We are happy people, and we don't need to, I mean, we don't need to strive for another thing than doing the best that we can do here and living the life as full and as good as you can. Most of the other ones, they try to, I mean, their goal is the afterlife. And this life is seen as just a torment on the way there.
Yeah.
That is a very big difference.
Yeah. And you mentioned in the section of the book where you talk about this, you mentioned the importance of the spiral. You say that the spiral, or, you know, perfectly represents our kind of process in of yeah. existence. And it's interesting you mentioned that, because I remember I was at a blot with a group that I met with some years ago, and we performed a very powerful kind of group galda or meditation. You know, we did some runic visualization, and this was just after a thunderstorm had occurred, you know, right in the middle of a rite that we performed. And both myself and a good friend of mine, Hammerson, we were all asked to speak about what we'd seen when we did this visualization, and both of us had seen a snail. And it struck me when I got to that point in your book, you know, you have a diagram of the spiral, and I mean, it's a, you know, basically the depiction of a snail shell.
Yeah, it is. True.
And if you could just talk a little bit about why you think the spiral well represents our kind of path through this existence.
Well, that symbol I got also from a ritual.
Okay.
And they showed me the way we are living. I mean, like the big circle, we're walking around. Everything is a circle in our belief. Nothing has a start or an end. It's a continuous movement.
Yeah.
And when you start to realize yourself somewhere on that path, you start to spiral inwards. And then when you really found yourself, or whatever that's called, you are in the center there, that little spot. And then you become, that is sort of the Vedic way or the Buddhist way, then you become at least aware of the spiral, of the ring, of it all. And you are not bound by it anymore. You're not bound walking that path if you don't want.
I suppose thinking about it, and I'm just kind of thinking aloud here, but when you're on that spiral going towards the center, the only time when you can see the totality of the spiral, as you just mentioned, is when you are at the center point. You know, when you're further out, if you're looking outwards, then you can only see the parts of the spiral that you have already traveled through. It's a symbol that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I call it the Ginnungagap, where everything meets and nothing is there.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, but it's not a contradiction, right? To say that if we return to Ginnungagap, that's not emerging with the oneness. It's just an awareness of the oneness, right?
Yeah. And I mean, discussing these things are like, I don't know.
Impossible.
it is. Our brain can't understand those concepts.
Yeah, of course.
We are not meant to understand non-understandable stuff.
yeah, for sure. So a lot of the kind of practices that you outline in the book are related to meditation. You talk about sitting at the base of a tree and things like this, which I agree is a wonderful way to meditate. And I do think, you know, and I'm a bit of a kind of hypocrite in saying this, but I do think that it is one of the most important things that we as pagans should be doing. And you know, someone once said to me that if you think that you don't have the time to do it, then that means you really, really need to do it. I've always held to that. But it is something that you need to get into a routine of, into a habit of. Is all of this what you're talking about, these knowing these parts of the self, that does that only happen through this meditative work? Do you think? Do you need to be meditating to kind of to begin to know these aspects, or do you think that you can come to know yourself without meditating?
Yeah, of course you can.
Okay. But yeah.
I mean, in rare occasions, for sure. But meditation is the tool that really, really helps. It is a super tool, actually. And yeah, we should really do that more.
Yeah.
All of us.
Yeah. Well, what I find, I think one of the barriers I find to meditation is that you put a lot of pressure on yourself. You know, you hear people talk about what they've experienced during meditation. In my case, the first time I did like a kind of, you know, so-called shamanic journey, it was deeply profound. I went into a very, very deep meditative state without any use of, you know, entheogens, drugs, even, you know, ritualistic drumming or anything like that. It was just purely through very basic kind of breathing techniques. And I went into a very, very deep meditation for quite a long period of time. I think, you know, it was probably about an hour or something. And I still remember what I experienced during that meditation to this day. So now when I go to meditate, it's always, I always come away from it feeling like I'm not able to achieve that same lucidity, that same kind of profound experience that I had the first time. But more recently, I've kind of forgiven myself for that. And I've just allowed myself to say, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you don't experience anything during meditation, even just sitting in a dark room for even just 10 minutes and practicing some breathing and not thinking about anything. And even if nothing comes to you, that is still beneficial, because I think that you're still, you're getting to know yourself in the sense that you're learning how to be comfortable with nothing but yourself. There's no outside stimulation. There's nothing, just you, your breathing, and a dark room. And even just that, I think is a good step.
Yeah, for sure. And a big enemy with all this ritualistic work is the expectation.
Yeah.
I had that also very long time when we went to stone circles and all those places here. You always expected to see things or hear things, or and when you didn't, you were a bit like, oh, didn't happen anything today. So get rid of expectation, because it's not the happening that is what you are seeking.
Yeah.
The happenings, they just come when they come, if they come.
Yeah. And in the Anglo-Saxon law, this, I mentioned it earlier, this part of the self that we call magan, which is the kind of the it's like the it's almost the kind of individualistic equivalent of hamingya. It's the the personal power that you amass through honorable deeds. The way that it is described is that you by doing honorable deeds, you increase your magan, and that therefore allows you to connect more closely with the spiritual realms. So perhaps, you know, we shouldn't expect anything from our meditations or our blots, but if in our normal day-to-day life, if we perform honorable deeds and we do good things for our folk, for our family, for our friends, you know, selfless acts, over time, they all amass to increase our honor. And then perhaps that then increases the chances of us experiencing things like, you know, direct communion with the gods or ancestors or the Fylgia or things like that. I don't know what you think about that, Anders.
Yeah, definitely. And what it does is attracts their attention. You can see it like you're becoming a sort of a light beam shining up in the night sky. And the stronger the stronger that beam is, the more attraction you get from them, or attraction, but they see you much easier. They know where to find you. Those deeds. And we call it Megan here. Megan,
yeah. I mean, that's Megan. Yeah, it's just a slight pronunciation difference. Yeah. I mean, maybe it's Megan here, but exactly, yeah. And that's a really, really good metaphor or way to visualize it there. I think, you know, you are like a beacon and or a light, and you the more you strengthen yourself by performing honorable deeds, the brighter you shine. And yeah, as you said, the easier it is for those entities in the other realms to find you and to interact with you.
And also the darker side, unfortunately. We need to mention that side.
Which is why we have to hallow the sacred space when we perform any ritual, right?
Yes. For many, many years, we didn't do that. And we had so many, not evil things, I'd say, but chthonic, darker side. And pure physical happenings. I've seen a friend of mine being beaten to the ground.
By an invisible force?
Yeah. He flew in the air. I've been hit in the stomach by an old priest. For real.
Yeah.
We have clothes being ripped, leather jackets being, when you heat up a leather piece and draw in it very hard, it stays like that. Yeah. Lots of things like that. But that all stopped when we started hallowing the circle.
That's incredible. I've not experienced anything like that, I must say. And I guess the one good thing about that is that if you have those kind of experiences, it probably means that you do have that you are shining brightly. So I guess it's kind of a double-edged sword. You're shining. It means that you are kind of on the right path, that you are probably a noble being, but in doing so, you're also attracting those dark powers.
Yeah.
Yeah, incredible. I'd like to talk a bit more about that for sure.
We can have a whole podcast about all those happenings.
we might need one. Yeah, I think people, because I did an episode called Divine Encounters where I talked about the few, and it sounds like you've had a lot more divine encounters than I have. But I know that was quite a popular one with the listeners to this podcast. People really enjoyed hearing about my experiences, and I'm sure that they would love to hear about yours.
The problem is there?
Yeah, what?
Expectations. We are building up the expectations.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, but people come away from it, thinking that they might have the same experiences. That's a problem I had for a long time. And sometimes you can become jealous of people who have had those experiences.
But they also come with a price. So. Yeah. People shouldn't be jealous about it.
I think we pretty much covered a good kind of introduction to the ideas in your book. And I hope that people are compelled to pick up a copy. But some of the things that you also talk about a little bit in the book, but from mutual friends that we've had, I'm told that you have some strong thoughts about the kind of the state of the world today. And one thing that you mention in the book is that membership of society is optional. There's a passage in your book which I just want to read out because it really stuck out to me, and it kind of echoes the thoughts that I've been trying to get across with the Fergan channel since 2020. You said that you weren't forced to be part, you realized at one point that you weren't forced to be part of or obey the laws of this artificial society. You mentioned that has nature been lured into this drama? And that's something I've, particularly with the whole kind of 2020 to where we are now, the whole COVID thing, the tyranny that has gripped society. I'm very careful these days not to say the world has gone mad, because the world, which includes nature, all of the animals, the whites, the spirits, the gods, the even the ancestors, they've not gone mad. It's only human society, as you put it, the artificial human society, that has gone mad in this time. So, why do you think that is?
Oh, that's by design.
Yeah.
When we give to our gods, they have their gods too. And what they give is our fear and our anxiety. They are thriving on that.
Yeah.
They need that. It's exactly the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what they are doing ritual on a mass scale to harness our fears.
Yeah. And what do you think about this? I made a Telegram post just today, actually, where I talked about, I personally, and this is only my hunch, you know, I'm not saying that I'm necessarily right or that I can prove this in any way, but my personal hunch is that the dark powers of this material realm, of this artificial society, they don't actually want to slaughter billions or millions or billions of people. As you said, they feed off of our fear and our anxiety. Would you agree with that?
Yes, slaughtering us would be counterproductive. Then they are left there alone. No, they want to keep us in this imaginary prison.
In the Norse lore, the giants, as they are so called, are known as the Jotnar, right? But in Old English, the word is Ettins, which etymologically, in terms of the meaning of the word, it derives from or is related to the word to eat. So I always think of that when I'm thinking about this concept that they feed off of our anxiety and our fear. These entities, the frost giants, they're not interested in our demise, our death. They're interested in feeding off of our anxiety and our fear. I don't know, that's an idea that I've kind of been throwing around for a while. And I know that some people would probably dispute it. They'd find some piece of law to dispute it. But yeah. I can't help thinking that it's not a coincidence that there is this link between eating or consuming amongst these negative entities.
Yeah, probably. But when we're talking about fear and anxiety, that all comes from duality in ourselves. And duality is one thing that they are really, really keen on, creating conflicts between groups.
And how do we defend against that? How do we get over that duality?
Well, first you need to sort of not be afraid. And not being afraid is knowing that there is nothing to this world that can hurt your soul.
Yeah.
You are free. You don't need to be what they made you into. You are a free spirit inside there. And that bond they can't control. But they are very, very much trying to find ways to. And maybe this AI thing could be, the things that they put in you, whatever it is.
mRNA injection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That might be a try to take over. I don't know.
So it seems to me like the whole purpose, going back to the purpose of your book, The Way of Wotan or Odinsveg, it's to create a closeness with one's Ond. And the closer we are with our Ond, the more obvious it becomes that we have nothing to fear.
We have nothing to fear except ourselves. No, but for real, it is a show. It's all a show. And when you realize that, you can just step out of it.
Yeah.
They still have the power over you. You have to go to work and all those things. You have to eat their crappy food. But you are free inside. And that is the most important thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, so people have suggested that you know, with regards to the, you know, and I don't know how much you want to get into this. I'm not going to assume that you share my views on this. So anyone listening should be aware that Anders may or may not share my views on this. But with regards to the COVID so-called vaccinations, some people have suggested, well, what if the vaccination is real and effective and is actually meant to protect people against a coming genuine pandemic, which is actually going to wipe out everyone who hasn't had the vaccination, things like that. I mean, you know, we can speculate about all these things, but I only mention that because my response to that has been, well, even if that were the case, at least I haven't willingly given up my dignity and my sense of autonomy over myself. And I think when you realize that you are a spiritual being, then that sense of autonomy over yourself, you know, being able to determine your own direction, that's what it's really about. It's not about whether, it's not even about whether the vaccination is good or bad. It's simply about the fact that you are the one who should always choose whether to engage with something like that.
Yeah, and this was a mass hysteria. I mean, it's quite interesting living during this time, seeing this. The world has never seen a global mass hysteria like this, ever.
No.
It's very crazy. And I think it's Socrates who says, or Plato maybe, where the masses go, don't go there.
Yeah.
And that is so true, because the masses, they react on feelings and emotions and fears. And yeah, you don't want to follow that.
Indeed, especially when you know that there are questionable people or even entities in power. If they are driving the masses in a certain direction, then I think you can, or you're, and you know, at the very beginning of the whole kind of so-called pandemic, this was my, you know, people said to me, oh, you know, we didn't know, it was very unclear early on. We didn't know what the truth was, so we just went in this way. And I said, well, but my default position is, if the globalists tell you to run in one direction, your first position should be to not run in that direction, if anything, to run in the opposite direction. Of course, then you should actually analyze the situation, because there can be like a double bluff where, and I think this happens in yeah, I think this happens in the alt media, where they kind of, they do call these double bluffs, where they say something knowing that dissidents are going to run in the other direction,
yeah,
when actually that is the direction they want everyone to run in. So you do have to be somewhat discerning about it. But as like a knee-jerk gut reaction, I'm not going to say gut reaction because that's the field gear's job, but as a knee-jerk reaction, you should probably at first not run where they want you to run, right?
True. And that is what I picked up after. I mean, what they didn't really anticipate, I think, is the amount of people that would see through this and from every different kind of layer in society
has joined.
Huge amounts of people have awoken to at least seeing that the world is a show.
Yeah.
And that is the first step to realizing something bigger.
Yeah, and I love in your book, you mention, you just very briefly, you talk about how life is a film set. And this ties into this idea that we really have nothing to fear, because this earthly existence that we experience here on Midgard is only one aspect of our overall eternal existence. And we are, I believe, here to learn. You know, this is why we are able to, why we have a leak, so that we are able to interact in this realm, to learn, to increase our Megan, you know, our overall kind of individual spiritual strength. So seen from that point of view, you know, things like the tyranny that we're facing today, not only should it not be feared, it should almost be embraced, because it's an opportunity to show what we're made of.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And a bit of ignoring. don't take it so serious. Yeah. Then you get into that stuff way too much and get trapped there instead.
Yeah.
Yeah, see it for what it is and okay, that's how it is. Let's do something about it.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I have another interest as well as heathenry and things like that. I have an interest in kind of understanding the law system, particularly in England and Wales. And I've come to realize that when you receive a letter which appears to be like a legal letter of some sort, most of the time you actually have nothing to worry about. I'm not advising people to ignore these things, especially if they don't understand them. But, you know, you start to notice things like when you receive a letter from a company that claims that you owe them money, they'll say things like may prosecute you, may take you to court and things like this. And it's all designed to create fear within you. And most people understandably do become very anxious with these things. They read that letter and their heart starts racing. They, you know, their brow starts sweating and immediately they phone up to pay whatever they're asked to pay, because, you know, we're kind of brought up with this idea that getting into legal trouble is like, you know, almost a fate worse than death. For most cases, when you know what you're doing, and again, I'm not advising people to ignore these things, especially if they don't understand them, but you're not going to be sent to jail for, you know, paying a utility bill 6 months late. You know what I mean? So I think I've learned to relax more about these things, you know, both the, you know, the bills that come in, the kind of legal demands that come in, but also, the way that people see you, you know, like your reputation. It's very liberating when you stand your ground, you plant your flag in the ground and say, this is what I am, this is what I believe. And whatever anyone thinks of that, whatever anyone wants to say, if they want to, you know, leave laugh emojis or whatever, it doesn't matter. It doesn't bother me, because I know myself, or I am trying to know myself. And yeah, as you said, it's, you know, I'm kind of rambling there, but yeah, I agree, life is like a film set.
Yeah, but what you say is very important, because that is what spiritual work will do for you. It will give you a confidence in yourself and not be a ship with other rudder in a stormy sea. No, but I know what I am. I don't need to pretend to fit in anywhere.
No.
But I shouldn't go around and be a dumbass just because I know who I am. But
we're just talking to you briefly now and through reading your book, I do very much get the sense that you are someone who does know himself. So whatever you've been practicing over the years, and I know that you're an experienced, you know, heathen practitioner, and you know, that knowledge comes through in the book. So whatever you're practicing, I believe works, because you do seem to have that kind of calmness and that confidence of someone who does know themselves and knows that there's nothing really to fear.
Yeah, and that actually comes from a happening. I don't know if... No, we leave it there.
Well, should we say that we'll do another episode together in, you know, in a couple of months' time or something, where we can talk about happenings and some of your kind of divine encounters, you know, the things that you've experienced, because I really would love to speak to you about those things.
Yeah, I will think about it.
Okay, all right.
I will think what will happen if one talks about those things.
Okay, well, no, I can understand that. I can understand that very much. Some of those things are private for a reason, and not just because one doesn't want to talk about them, but because, yeah, I understand where you're coming from.
And with sort of, if we say magic, it's like a balloon sometimes. You can puncture it. So one shouldn't speak for some reason. Some things shouldn't be outspoken, because then you sort of puncture the magic in it.
I agree. It's like the, you know, I strongly believe that one shouldn't film blots, you know, with video camera, or take photos. You know, I think in some cases it's okay to take a photo perhaps during the preparation or afterwards or things like that, if there's a good reason for doing so. But that's a kind of a very profane thing to do during a very sacred
experience. Sure.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I have to take a picture of every Odin bloat.
Okay, yeah.
Because I need to, I mean, today people need pictures.
Hmm.
But, well, it did work. And,
well, maybe that's the one exception then. That's an understandable one.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just to in closing, I've been told that you are writing another book. Is that true?
No.
No? Okay.
The thing is, I could write many books, but you need to find the right space. That's the problem.
The right physical space to sit and write.
But otherwise, I've tried lots of times. But for this book, I found a very strange place, but it was totally right.
Okay. Yeah.
It was underground and with lots of humming machines around.
Right, okay.
Very strange place to write this book, but it flowed.
Yeah.
And it took not that long time at all.
It reads as if it came out of you very naturally.
Yeah, it did. And I actually wrote it on the phone as well.
Okay. What? So someone else was transcribing while you were speaking?
No. I was writing.
Oh, sorry. Oh, you mean you literally on like a smartphone? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Very strange.
See, I'm showing my Luddite side there when I'm automatically assuming that on the phone means speaking rather than using it as a computer. But no, I agree. So, I'm very interested in that idea as well. As a musician, that the place that you are when you compose something has a strong bearing on what you compose, and it's interesting to think about how the book would have turned out if you'd been in a serene forest or something.
Yeah, but I think when I think actually underground was the thing, because the phone didn't have any reception down there.
Yes.
I think it was something like that.
Yeah.
Not affected.
Yeah. Yeah, brilliant.
I need to build a bunker.
I was kind of imagining that that's where you were, but
no, it wasn't. It wasn't.
it sounds like that's what you need. Yeah, an inspirational place for you.
Inspirational bunker. That's a new thing.
Yeah. So the other thing, just lastly, is that you are. I was sent a link to your Etsy page because you're a craftsman as well, and what I hear from people is that you are, people who obviously respect you highly say that you are pretty much able to, you know, craft anything with your hands, and this is obviously something that you've taken on since ceasing to be a bricklayer in your in your past. What kind of stuff do you make?
Mostly statues of the gods, and when I get a vision, I do them. So I sculpt them in clay first, and then I make a silicone mold and, continue casting.
Yeah, amazing. It's not just commissions, you know, you don't only make things that people have asked you to make. You also make things that you want to make or that you feel compelled to make.
Yeah, I don't have time to to do other stuff.
I'm jealous.
But that's also Vode. I mean, the use of Vode. And what you said with Willy.
Yeah.
Giving Vode. You need to control it. And then you can start create. That's very good.
It's that balance, isn't it? That balance of control and world.
Good.
Yeah.
So, statues mostly and some, archaeology...
Replicas, artifacts, yeah.
And I cost a lot of things in bronze for some museums and actually for some scientists now.
Brilliant.
Which is very nice. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really the stuff I've seen is really quite impressive. And you know, for those listening, I'll put a link in the description for this episode to Anders' Etsy shop.
Thank you, and the book is also there, of course.
Oh yeah, yeah, great.
Yeah,
yeah.
Otherwise, you can find the book at Amazon.
Yeah.
Also, yeah.
Yeah. If you really must use Amazon, then do so. But is there anything else you wanted to add in this conversation, Anders? Because otherwise, it's been really fascinating, and I've really enjoyed speaking with you.
Same, but last words might be, don't fear. There's nothing to fear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there was. If you don't mind me. Adding, you finish your book with hopefully you don't mind me saying this. These are Anders' words. He says, do right and fear no one.
Mm.
And I think that's that pretty much sums up our ambitions as heathens, really.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And as humans.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, well, excellent. Well, thank you very much for making time to speak with me, Anders. And if you decide that you'd like to discuss some other things another time, maybe some of your experiences, then let me know. Otherwise, I completely understand. Thank you very much.
Yeah, hey, Lordin.
Yeah, hey, Lordin. Well, that was another conversation which I feel very privileged to have had. And I hope that you all investigate Anders' work further. To end this episode, we'll look at last episode's riddle from the Exeter Riddle Book. And this one, I think I mentioned at the end of last episode that I was particularly interested in the kind of numerological aspect of this one. So I reread it, and I couldn't really make much of the numbers. In hindsight, I should have done, but I took this more literally, like most riddles. And I thought, you know, when it talks about men riding down to the estuary and being able to cross upon one steed, I think it says that they were able to cross by one steed. And I thought, well, okay, maybe that must be a boat. But then it says that they did not swim nor wade on the bottom, nor muddy the water, nor ride on the wind. So then I thought, well, okay, it can't be a boat. Maybe it's like a jetty or a bridge, even something like that. What I found particularly interesting, I liked the line when it says 11 of those mounted men had horses of peace and 4 had pale grey horses, which sort of implies that a horse of peace, I guess, would be a white horse. So that would be kind of like another way of saying white horse would be to call it a horse of peace. But all of that was kind of in vain, because looking at the answer to this riddle, I was way off. And actually, the numerological facet of the riddle is key to it, seemingly. And I'm just going to read out the entire answer for this one, because it's very interesting. Although some commentators believe that the answer to this riddle is the circling stars, or the Great Bear, or Charles's Wain, and cite Aldhelm's riddle Arcturus as a remote analogue, the evidence in favour of the solution, the month of December, seems to me to be conclusive. The 60 men are the 60 half-days or days and nights of the month. There are many examples of the Anglo-Saxons' habit of counting in halves. The 11 men mounted on horses of peace are the month's 4 Sundays and 7 feast days. Conception of the Virgin, St. Nicholas, St. Thomas, Christmas, St. Stephen, St. John Evangelist, Holy Innocents. The water divides one year from the next, and the opposite side is therefore January. These ramifications are rather elaborate, but see the introduction for a discussion of the time riddle. So this is a really elaborate and sophisticated riddle. Amazingly so, really. When you read stuff like that, I just don't see how anyone can dispute the intelligence or sophistication or, you know, artistic thinking ability of our ancestors. So anyway, let's move on to the next riddle for this episode, riddle number 23, and it reads as follows. Wob's my name, if you work it out. I'm a fair creature fashioned for battle. When I bend and shoot a deadly shaft from my stomach, I desire only to send that poison as far away as possible. When my lord, who devised this torment for me, releases my limbs, I become longer and, bent upon slaughter, spit out that deadly poison I swallowed before. No man's parted easily from the object I describe. If he's struck by what flies from my stomach, he pays for its poison, with his strength, speedy atonement for his life. I'll serve no master when unstrung, only when I'm cunningly notched. Now guess my name. So in contrast to the last riddle that we just looked at the answer for, this one would seem to be pretty obvious. I'm not going to look ahead at the answer to this one, but I think we can all have a good guess at that one. And let's see if we've been fooled into thinking it's more simple than it really is next episode of the Fergan podcast. And as always, thank you very much for joining me in this episode. And anyone who's interested in supporting this, consider becoming a patron on Patreon, Substack, Subscribestar. Have a look at fergen.com, fyrgen.com. There's an arc. You can listen to all of the past episodes for free there. You can contact me for any reason. You can have a look at the merchandise, which is of the highest quality, all screen printed on with water-based inks, not digitally printed on Teespring or anything like that. All 100% organic cotton. Yeah, good quality stuff. Original designs, all my own designs. And thank you all for listening, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next episode of the podcast.